This is April 28th, 2010. We're in Boca Raton with Dr. Povar. Dr. Povar, start by talking about your parents, how they came to this country, how you grew up, and your brother.
Okay. My mom and dad came over as Russian immigrants. My dad was about 17 or 18 years old. My mother was about 16. My dad's history was much more dramatic. He was 16 years old in Russia and was due to be drafted into the Russian army. Dad walked from Moscow to Hamburg, Germany. They were poor as church mice. He just had this ticket for steerage passage to America. We had relatives in Hamburg that were engineers and well-to-do, and he was given their address so that he would be able to wait for the ship. It took him 3 months to get to Hamburg on foot. He was bedraggled and miserable-looking. He had a note written for him in German introducing who he was, and he went to the house and offered it to the lady of the house. She looked up and down the street and slammed the door in his face, which he never forgot. He managed to hang around till the ship left, got to New York, and was very successful. Almost immediately earned a living, went to night school, learned English. He had two jobs. He worked in textiles during the day. He also worked in an umbrella factory, cutting fabric for the umbrellas. That's where my mother worked as a sewer. And that's where they met, and that's where they married. My father continued to do very well and earned excellent living, brought all his other 8 brothers and sisters to the States, plus his mother and father, over a period of years. My mother always said that while he was bringing them over, she was scrubbing floors on her hands and knees because they couldn't afford anything. All the money went for that purpose. But he really did well through the 20s and 30s. Dad was the godfather of the entire family. He controlled everyone's lives. I was scheduled to go to Lowell Textile to become a textile person. My brother was in sales at several of the men's wear firms, but he hated it and worked on a farm. We had this rural background, both of us, that influenced our lives a great deal. He eventually went to Cornell. Ralph was a very good surgeon and a good diagnostician. When we worked together, I tended to see more of the people, and he tended to work more in the back. Ralph was an ag student and then went on to vet school. I knew that he was graduating, and I was very anxious to get up to Cornell while he was still there because I knew he would pave the way for me to earn some money while I was there, and it turned out exactly that way.
Why did you go to Brooklyn College initially instead of going right to Cornell?
We were in the depths of the Depression in the 30s, and we lost our home. And I didn't have the $150 I needed to buy my books and pay my fees at Cornell. So I stayed and went 1 year to Brooklyn College and worked and saved. And then I worked as a children's waiter at a hotel and earned enough money so I had an adequate amount of money to go up to Cornell that fall. But I took courses at Brooklyn College. I got full credit for all the courses I took. When I came up to Cornell, Ralph had a job for me stoking the furnace in the house that paid for my room rent. He had a job for me at Alpha Cairo, working as second cook, making salads and stuff like that. And that entitled me to 3 meals a day, but I only could get down there for the 1 meal at night. I had an NYA job, National Youth Administration, and that paid me $15 a month, and that was the cash. And with that, we were able to get by because there was no tuition. Just had to pay lab fees and books. It amounted to somewhere between $75 and $150 a year that you had to have in cash. We were able to get used books sometimes to help reduce the cost. Once the military came in, they supplied all our books. It was for the kids who were poor. That was the biggest lift that we ever had because they picked up the cost of all the books and they fed us. I still worked to get some cash, but I didn't really have to anymore in the last couple of years.
Could you talk about your experience in the Army as an undergrad when you were in the agricultural college?
At Cornell, all the male students were in the ROTC unit. We had a mounted cavalry unit. So we had a strange phenomenon that your rank in the unit was determined by your previous grades. By freak of fate, I happened to have the best grades in our unit of several hundred students, and therefore I became the commander of the unit. when we were in parade formation, we had a regular army officer in charge, and it was very important to have the height of the soldiers lined up evenly. And since I was one of the shortest people in the unit, I had to have the tallest horse in the unit so that my head was even with everybody else's. And that created all kinds of problems of getting the halters on the horse and get them harnessed so that you could ride them. The horse certainly sized me up immediately, and the minute he would see me going into the stalls, he'd raise his head up to the ceiling, and then I'd have to scramble through the manger and the water dish and everything to get up there to grab his halter and pull his head down. At his halter, he behaved perfectly well, and we had no trouble. But this became a weekly episode where all the kids used to stand and watch this business of my catching my horse. It was embarrassing, but could do nothing about it.
You wanted to become a veterinarian, but your brother had an incident that precluded that, at least initially.
Yes. I was working with Dr. Hutton Cole, and we were working on the genetics of disease resistance. In our conversations at work we were doing together, it was decided that it would be wonderful if I had this inclination towards veterinary medicine, if I would get a veterinary degree and then join the team, and that would add credibility to their pathology that they were doing. That got me thinking about veterinary medicine, and I applied my junior year and was refused. There was a political problem. My brother had behaved incorrectly with Dr. Frost, and Dr. Frost was furious with him. The problem that my brother had gotten himself into was he was a junior senior year and was in charge of a small group that was caring for this patient, a horse, and the horse was lame. And it was customary in those years for any lameness to be demonstrated to Dr. Frost so he could diagnose it and educate the student, the class, as to what was going on. Well, the whole class was lined up to watch this horse limp through the stable and out the patio and turn around and come back. And Dr. Frost felt he knew what was wrong with the horse's lameness, but he didn't really know. My brother had found that the horse had a large shard of wood stuck into the fetlock. After Dr. Frost had come through his diagnosis without examining the horse, just from the action of the horse, my brother reached down and removed the piece of wood, and the horse walked off perfectly normally. And Dr. Frost made it very clear that there would never be another Povar in the veterinary school. Well, when we learned that, we sort of gave up on Cornell. Dean Hagen called me when I was up at the poultry department, and he informed me that Dr. Frost was going to be on spelling, and he thought it would be wise if I was going to consider an application to put it through, which I did immediately, and it went through uneventfully. So that's how I got into veterinary school. It was a strange evolution. Interest in veterinary medicine came not under the influence of any veterinarian, as far as I was concerned, but more the work I was doing. The problem was going to Cornell during a time when there was no air conditioning, and going in the summertime was a hideous experience. I had a little dog, a Cocker Spaniel, Taffy, who went to college with me. She was absolutely perfectly behaved, and she'd just get under your seat and you'd hear a peep out of her until we'd go out to the next class. And everybody knew her, and she was a delightful dog. In one of the classes, Dr. Zeisig was lecturing to us about meat inspection. He was actually reading the USDA textbook on that. It was boring. It was hot. The room must have been 90 degrees. No air. At one point, Taffy gets out from under my seat, sits right in the middle of the lecture hall, and lets out the most earth-shattering yawn you can imagine. Dr. Zeisig looked up and he said, "Well, if Taffy can't stand it, none of us can go." It saved our lives that day. It was awful. From school, we were put in a blacked-out train and sent from Cornell overnight. That was in 1944. Went right from graduation onto the train, the whole class, and we were shipped. We didn't know where, but we ended up at Fort Dix. We went to the barracks, and they immediately started inoculating us with everything under the sun. Some of the kids were sick as hell. Most of us didn't feel well. We were supposed to be there for about a couple of weeks after the shots were done. We were going to be shipped out. We didn't know where. One morning, there about a week, they called my name and said to report to headquarters. I ran as fast as I could to headquarters, and I get there, and a sergeant hands me a slip of paper. He says, "You got to go to Rutgers tomorrow morning. Here's your bus ticket stub." And the name on the stub was Dr. Baudet. Nobody could tell me what it was about. I got down to Dr. Baudet, and he was very charming, and he said, "Glad I have a qualified person." I said, "Qualified for what?" He said, "You're going to run a laboratory. You're qualified. You worked with poultry. You majored in microbiology. You were a veterinarian. And your card is the only one that came up. I've been looking for a veterinarian, Dr. Black, the man who ran the laboratory in Vineland, had a heart attack. And I had to have a veterinarian to replace him. So the Army agreed to identify somebody. You got identified." So I went down there, and there were three employees, and they trained me in 1 month how to run a laboratory. It was really remarkable. I knew enough about poultry pathology from my work with podets and so on that I could do the autopsies. I knew enough microbiology and get my cultures done. And Goldhaps were right next door. They taught me about virology. And I stayed there until Dr. Black recovered. I was there for 7 months, and I was shipped off to California. I had met Lottie in the meantime, and she was a student at Rutgers. And I called her and I said, "Lottie, they're sending me to California. You want to go?" And she said, "Sure." And that was my wedding proposal. At the end of the war, I was involved in some biological warfare work on the West Coast in Kimber Farms. And there was the absolute perception that there would be a biological attack on the United States. And we were making vaccines against everything that we could conceivably do. And I had applied to the University of California at Berkeley to go on for my PhD. Then I got a letter from my brother asking me to come there because he had brucellosis badly and was very ill. He had been in the Army. He had brucellosis at that time. He had collapsed in California and was discharged summarily due to that and had undulant fever attacks every 2 to 4 weeks. He had 2 children at the time. It was not possible for him to practice under those circumstances. So he said, if I could come and help him. We canceled our plans to go to University of California, Davis, and went to Providence instead and worked with him. It took until 1952 before he was treated successfully. I had brucellosis myself in 1951 and was treated with Oreomycin. It had just come out. Our family physician had been at a conference at Johns Hopkins. We got gifts from Ledley, and I was put on Oreomycin. I've been absolutely free of it. I have no titer for it or anything, but I developed a bonelli infection for which I had to be hospitalized for 3 weeks afterwards because that almost killed me. The Oreomycin was bad that way. It killed everything except the molds. They wouldn't treat Ralph with Oreomycin because of my horrible experience, but when Terramycin came out, when he had an attack, they put him on the dose, and he reverted to negative, despite the fact he had a titer all his time. And was cured. He never had any further trouble after that. But it was about 9 years after I joined him before he was really cleared of the problem.
Could you describe the practice?
At the time I joined Ralph in 1946, we had a general practice. We had a lot of swine, horses, a lot of dairy cattle, and about 30% was small animals. We took over a practice that belonged to a man named Armstrong, Dr. Armstrong, who had a stroke and died. His wife owned the buildings. The practice was on First Street in East Providence, which was a livery stable street. The practice was in a wooden barn. There were horse stalls, and we converted those horse stalls into runs for the few dogs that we had in the practice. We built an examining room, and we built a waiting room in the barn. I came in the summers and built for them a bedroom and a sitting room and a kitchen on the opposite side of the barn and parked the car in between. When I joined the practice, that's the facilities we had. We started putting cages into some of the horse stalls, and my dad helped us out of the Depression. He gave us a gift in which we were able to get a mortgage, and we built a new hospital in front of the old hospital. That became Povar Animal Hospital. It's still there.
How did you transition into small animal work completely?
I was called back in 1952 to military service for the Korean War. And at that time, my brother felt that he could not do the large animal and the small animal anymore. Also, the large animal work had decreased very markedly. Horses were out, and we still had dairy cattle work. We still had some swine work. And he continued to do a little bit of that. When I came back from service in 1954, we contracted with the island of Martha's Vineyard to do the large animal work there. We would fly over there once a month to do pregnancy work and any other veterinary work that the small animal clinic on the island would not do. So we took care of the pigs and the sheep and the goats and so on, as well as horse. We loved to do that. It was at a flat rate. It was utopian. The amount of work you did was just dependent on what had piled up during the time, but you never had to consider the cost. They just paid for any medication that you used, and you got a flat rate for the day and transportation and being at a wonderful place. We both enjoyed that. We did that for over 10 years.
Could you describe your experience during the Korean War, 52 to 54?
The Korean War, I had done laboratory work in World War II, so they sent me to Chicago initially. We were trained on meat inspection and food inspection in general for 3 months. And then I was sent in a unit to New York City, which was replacing a unit that had gotten into trouble with a bribery scandal in New Jersey. They dispersed the entire unit. Ours was a unit made up of reserve officers. Our colonel was a reserve officer. All the majors were reserve officers. I was a reserve officer. In those days, you could not resign your medical commissions. It was only after Eisenhower changed the law that you could resign. But up to that time, you had a medical commission. It stayed with you, and you could be called up at any time. I became adjutant to the colonel. And as such, I ran the office and took care of 50 officers and enlisted men under me in the office. We did that for 2 years. I worked hard in my life, but I never worked that hard, ever. It was a very grueling thing because we were under constant stress of having the previous unit disbanded due to fraud, bribery. We were all reserve officers, and we wanted to get out, not be jailed in the process. It was very stressful.
So could you describe what an average week would be like?
I was in the office around 8 o'clock in the morning. We worked till 5, 6 o'clock at night. As adjutant, my services were different than other inspectors because, in a sense, I was acting for the colonel all the time. But I ran the office, and I did all the special inspections. Whenever somebody wanted a contract to supply stuff to the government, I had to go down and do the inspection for the colonel. That ran into all kinds of problems. And then we also had huge contracts for specialized items, say, chicken chop suey, which I'll never forget. It was made by Dorset Packing Company. It was a multi-million dollar contract. It was a wonderful product. Everything they had in there was fresh and good, and the product looked beautiful. And when it was all packed, it was overseas shipment. There were strapped cartons, all dipped in wax, and a tremendous cost. And then I had to do the inspection before it got the veterinary stamp on it. And unfortunately, the boxes were atrocious. The military specifications allowed so much space between the flaps and the top, and those things were out about twice as far as they should have been, and I had to reject it, and there was chaos. Millions of dollars floating out of this thing. I got a call from an admiral. The vendor had an admiral call me, who ordered me to stamp those boxes. And I said I would be happy to do it if you just sent me a telegram ordering me to do so. He thought that was impertinent. He called my colonel and reported that I was insubordinate. And the colonel had a favorite saying that went on for years. He said, "Povar, you better be right." Of course, when he came down, there was no question about it. If it wasn't for overseas shipping, it would have been a catastrophe. Those boxes had to be right or they would sink. The ship gets hit and these would not float. We had any number of incidents where I had to do inspections of plants. I had one I'll never forget where it was a small butcher who was going to bid on packaging stuff for the submarine service, which is the highest level of difficulty anybody could have. I had to go down and look at his place and approve it first before he could get a contract. And I walked in and I knew from the condition of the place immediately that it was not going to pass. I asked my driver to wait. I said, "Driver, I'll only be here 15 minutes. I walked in and this place smelled bad. I walked into the cooler, the temperature was too high. He saw me reading the thermometer, and he picks out a lot of money, and he says, "Captain, it's worth a lot to me, dude." And I tore out of that room fast as I could, went running for my driver, went down the street, didn't have cell phones in those days, got to a phone and called the colonel. I knew it was going to be trouble. And Kurt says, you're too late. He already called and said that you demanded a bribe in order to get him passed. I said, well, Colonel, you go down and see the place, and you know what they want the bribe to pass that place. He came out, and it turned out all right. Those are the kind of things that add a spice to your life. After the two-year service in the Korean War, I was finally discharged, and it was during that time that I had correspondence from Dr. Bill Montagna, who had been a professor of mine at Cornell in histology, and now was a biology at Brown. He was doing a comparative study on glandular development in primates, and he needed somebody to do biopsies for him from different primates. And I had been working with primates in the military because we were buying monkeys for the trajectory flights of the rockets. So I had more than usual exposure to them. He set aside an area of the hospital where we just did the monkey work. All these were survival surgeries to take out a little piece of a lymph gland and some skin. After they recovered, they would be sent back to wherever they were donated from. We went from prosimians all the way up to apes. This took several years. But during that time, I was up and back at Brown a lot. Dr. Alan Shark wanted to start a primate colony for the psychology department for his own work. He was told that I was around the campus, and he consulted with me, and we started working very closely together. And we did have a successful breeding colony of stump-tailed macaques, and we had a large colony of rhesus monkeys. He used all these animals in his behavioral work. I was spending so much time at Brown in these various affairs, I started giving a course in surgical techniques in primates for the psychology department, mostly electrode implants, things like that. And they gave me an adjunct appointment at that time to cover the work I was doing. At the same time, the medical school in the late 60s was being thought about. We had architects working on a large central animal facility for the whole campus, and it was suggested that I be available to them to discuss any animal problems, any suggestions that we would have. And this was a very fruitful arrangement for all of us. The building was built, it was a huge, the animal facility was almost as big as the whole medical school because it was supposed to serve more than just the medical school, the whole biology campus. Since I had been so involved in getting it planned, they wanted to see if I could make it work. We accepted the challenge and the marked reduction in salary and went on and spent the next 20 years, really the happiest years of my life. We enjoyed every moment of it. The building did work well. And when I retired, three veterinarians replaced me. That's what happens when you grow with a job, you know.
This has been marvelous.